Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd.
Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Crane, and you're listening to another great episode of Improv Nerd. Our guest today is Nick Armstrong. He is the artistic director of the West Side Comedy Theater in Santa Monica, California. He is also the camp director and founder of Improv Utopia, and he performs with the long-running Harold Team King 10 at IO West. He's appeared on such TV shows as The Office and Grey's Anatomy, and he is just one of those people who is so passionate about improv and is always giving to the improv community because he wants to make it stronger. We talk to him about the importance of having an improv coach. He shares with us an exercise from one of his classes that he uses to help people get out of themselves and become more silly. And he tells us what it's like to really be an artistic director. But before we get to that, my voice is a little hoarse, and I'll tell you why. You knew I was going to tell you anyways. Yesterday in group therapy, one of the members of group therapy was struggling with some anger that he had buried down. And so he had asked me we all sit in a circle, to get up in a circle with him. This sounds like an improv exercise, and the scary thing is, maybe I'll try this. And so we stood facing each other, and then we put our hands up and touched. You know, we were both touching our hands, like we were bracing against each other, and we just screamed at each other and yelled at each other. And when we do those kind of things, I know I should know better because I'm an actor, an improviser. I should always use more of my stomach support, more from my diaphragm, but I always forget, and then my voice always sounds like I smoked a pack of cigarettes before I did this podcast. And here's the weird thing about anger. I'm an angry person. You guys know I am a very angry person. But when I do exercises like this, the next morning I wake up and I have like a sad hangover. Like I feel sad, like really sad all day. And so that's what I felt, really, really, really sad. And which was good because I had a funeral to go to. My cousin, who I really, really liked very much, died. She was 77 years old. That contributes to my sadness. So we took Betsy. It was Betsy's 13 months now. It was Betsy's first funeral, and my mom was there, and she was like, "Oh, Betsy, it's your first funeral." 'Cause my mom loves funerals. I love funerals. I love funerals actually more than I love weddings. I actually like a wake. And if you are not familiar with a wake, it's kind of a lost thing here. The night before, they have usually they'll have the body out in a casket, or they'll have the if you're cremated, they'll have the urn there, and everybody comes, you know, the night before for 3 or 4 hours or something, like 5 to 9 or something. That is my favorite thing. I would rather go to a wake than a wedding, which just tells you how fucked up I am. Anyways, it's so great to be back. It's so great to share this episode with you because Nick Armstrong has, oh my God, he has so much to offer you in terms of just practical stuff and in terms of this exercise he shares with us. And he's just one of those guys who is giving so much, constantly giving back to the improv community. So here it is, the Nick Armstrong episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
Nick Armstrong, thank you for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
Thank you for having me.
You grew up in Sacramento, California, and you said you got into plays around 10 years old, when you were about 10?
Yes, correct.
Do you remember the first play that you were in where it was like, oh my God, I love this? You're laughing.
I thought you might ask this. So my grandma, actually, every summer, I grew up on a farm up there, and she would get me in something every summer. And it was like roller skating or horseback riding or something weird. And then finally she's like, well, she took me to this theater all the time. I was like, I like that. I want to be on stage. I'd rather not be watching it. And she goes, okay, I'll get you in that. So you paid basically to be in this play. You didn't audition. And so she got me in it. It was a musical. I am not a musical person. I had a little bit of a lighter voice when I was 10. But I did this thing. I had no clue what I was doing. I felt lost completely the whole time, but I loved every second of it. And I was like, you know, I really like this. I like the people. I like the spectacle. I like performing and entertaining people. So the bug just kind of caught me, and that was what hooked me, I think, and I just kept doing it after that. That was the one thing. I said no to roller skating.
The other thing I thought that was interesting is you also were into sports growing up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you admitted, even though you weren't good at them, you still thought they were fun, which I really almost think is a good preparation to improv, because I was always the person, if I didn't do well at a sport, I just didn't do it.
Yeah, you know, like, the thing that I loved about sports is what I love about improv. It's the community, the camaraderie. So I played football. So like that, it's a troop. You're a troop. Everybody has a part. It's all about support. So I think I really connected to that and that kind of camaraderie. And I think that's very much alive in improv. So I think it all kind of mixes together, especially in football. So I would ride the pine, but I definitely love sticking around and rooting on my friends from the sidelines.
You also said that you when you were growing up, SNL, Saturday Night Live, was a big influence. Mm-hmm. But your parents wouldn't let you watch it. Was it because it was too late or because of the material?
You know, it's weird because my parents used to be big hippies. And then they wouldn't let me watch things like The Simpsons or SNL, but my mom would let me watch Dallas, which I thought was odd because I thought that was more risky than anything I was trying to watch. But I think I really don't have the answer. I feel that it was like they probably thought it was not for kids to see alone or something. It was really weird. But I would sneak watch it all the time. It was really easy to sneak past and watch it.
And Chris Farley was a big impact on you. In what way?
Well, here's a guy that just, I mean, you know, you know Chris. I mean, like, he was just pounding it, just 120% commitment. I mean, and here's a big guy, and I was a big kid, still a big kid, you know, that saw this bigger guy using his body and just not caring and going like, this is me, this is who I am, and I'm also really funny. And that really connected to a kid who was overweight and saw this as a role model for me, going like, oh, it doesn't matter. I can still be funny. I can use my body. I don't have to be ashamed of it. I can just be, this is how I am. And that really connected with me with Chris Farley. Not only the physical stuff, but just that he was really funny and I connected with that.
I was also a very overweight kid, 300 pounds when I graduated high school. Was your humor coming out of that? Because my humor was coming out of that, like, you know, I want to fit in. I'm the fat kid, so I've got to develop something, and I'd rather make fun of myself than have others make fun of me.
I probably think there's a little bit of that. I was like, you know what? If they're going to make fun of me, I might as well just use it and be proud of it and make it not, you know, because if you let people, you figure out if you let people just, you know, go down on you and make fun of you and it hurts you, they're going to try to hurt you more. So I was like, well, screw this. I guess my shield is I just use it. And then they were like, oh, he's actually really funny and and a good guy. So, you know, I kind of grew up in a not a rough neighborhood, but where people were really bully-like and stuff like that. And I turned it around. I said no. I said, you know what? Like, and then I really started acting like Chris Farley. Like, I would do his jokes. I was like the Beatles back then. Like, you start out. I was like copying his jokes. I would do his sketches. I would do everything. And everybody's like, oh, he's like Chris Farley. He's so funny. Like, you know, and I just started doing that and it turned around for me, you know.
Were you at parties and people would say, oh, do the Chris Farley?
Yeah, sometimes they would do that. They wouldn't necessarily maybe see Chris Farley, but they knew I could do it. So, but then like it started to adapt my own point of view in comedy, and you know, I'm definitely not a Chris Farley type anymore when I was back then. But like, you know, it definitely helped me get a point of view. And I kind of use the Beatles analogy because, you know, they copied Chuck Berry and a bunch of people at the beginning and then started developing their own point of view. And I feel that happened for me.
Because certainly Bob Newhart was a big influence of me. And I know probably the first 10 years I was doing a Bob Newhart impersonation when I was improvising. For people that don't understand, like, taking somebody else's voice, how that leads to developing your own voice.
Yeah, I do. And I do tell my students that sometimes. I'm like, it's okay to copy your favorite improviser. Like, you know, when I was loving Chris Farley, but then when I started at Iowa West, I was loving Craig Kukowski and all these other performers. And I would watch them and go like, oh, I like how they play. And I would mimic that a little bit. But I think you need stuff like that. And then you start to figure out who you are in that. And it goes from there. You don't stake a Craig Kukowski or a Chris Farley or any of that. You eventually figure out who you are. And I think that's okay.
And now around 1997, you move from Sacramento to LA. Mm-hmm. And you go and see a show. I believe it's around 2000 or 2001. You go to Iowa West. Mm-hmm. And you go, and this is the first time you've seen long form in a Herald. What changes for you that night?
Oh my gosh, Jimmy. I mean, I still remember this so fresh in my head because it was like an epiphany moment, and I don't have many in my life. So it was, you know, I was doing theater at the time at Long Beach State, and I had graduated with writing, directing, and acting in theater. And I had never seen, I'd seen short form and done that. And it was fine. It was always fun. And I loved it. But when I saw this, this was a theatrical experience. It mixed what I love about theater and what I love about improv and pushed them together. And I was like, this is great. I love comedy. I love theater. This is it. I watched the show and I'm like, I've never seen this before, but this is what I want to do the rest of my life. And literally signed up for classes the next day. I mean, I was just so taken by it.
And then you start taking classes at Iowa West. Tell us a little about that, the improv scene back then when you were starting taking classes.
Oh, wow. So there wasn't really much going on in LA. That was because improv wasn't really popular out here at that point. You had the Groundlings, but that's 90% sketch, you know. And you always knew it as a sketch theater, not maybe improv. And then I think Acme was around, but I didn't know much about them at the time, and it wasn't as a big thing. But so you, at the time, you're like, oh, well, I'll go to the Groundlings. But when I saw the IO thing, I was like, they were new out there. And I was like, you know, this is really calling to me right now. And I always have followed my gut with like, whatever is connecting to you, just do it. And so I did it, and I never looked back, and I started the Groundlings much later, which I'm very happy I did because it's such a harder thing. But yeah, it was a very small scene. There was barely any improvisers. I mean, at the time, now I think IO has like 3 or 4 level one classes. Back then it was like one and you all went through it together. I mean, it was very the beginnings of something. And I think IO kind of really started catapulting the scene in LA because out of that grew UCB LA and the PAC Theater and stuff. It just started blossoming all these different theaters. So yeah.
And one team you get on when you're when you started out at Iowa West is a team called Night Terror. And you do a form called the JTS Brown, which was originated here at Iowa Chicago. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little about that form.
Well, I like to – it is a form, but I also, like Craig has taught me, it's a philosophy of play. You know, there is a kind of a form to it, but it's, you know – my friend Brian O'Connell says it kind of funny. He goes, the Herald is algebra. The deconstruction is calculus. Well, I call the JTS Brown Picasso's cubism period. So like it's a fever dream. It's very dream logic. Anything can happen at any point. Any scene can exist and then not exist. There's no edits. There's all transformations. So you're not like swiping. You're just, I can become a new character in the middle of the scene, and then that's just a new scene. Someone walks in, it's a new scene. Someone walks out, it's a new scene. So, like, it takes a heightened awareness, a heightened group mind to kind of get it, because it's anything and everything can happen at a moment's notice, and you have to notice the slightest change. But there's also injected kind of short form games in it, you know, where you do like a third degree, where three people run out and ask you questions about, like, you know, who are you to each other? You know, where are you right now? To try to add information to the scene. They're used to kind of help things along. And there's like shadowing, where you're like the id, the ego, and the superego of this character. And you're these shadows, almost like Peter Pan, you know, Peter Pan's shadow. So it's very interesting and very... it's an odd form and very, very difficult to do.
And as I remember, here in Chicago, when they did it, they had a very long and committed rehearsal process. Mm-hmm. How was your rehearsal process when, Craig directed, JTS Brown out there in LA?
Well, Craig approached us about it because we didn't necessarily, we wanted to do the Herald, but then he said, I think you guys are ready to do this and it hasn't been out here. And he said, well, let's try it. So we rehearsed, you know, for a little bit, but the form was already kind of developed at that point, so we didn't have to develop anything new. So we hit the stage pretty much maybe a couple months after we started rehearsing, but we religiously rehearsed every week, Sunday mornings at 10 a.m., rain or shine. We were younger then, so coming off a Saturday night, that was pretty religious. And then we had a show that night, too. So we rehearsed in the morning, hang out all day together, and then have the show at night. And, you know, we struggled with it. We were younger back then, and it was tough. But, you know, Craig being our mentor and stuff really, really worked with us every week. I mean, we barely missed a week, you know, and the whole team was there usually, too. You know, it was pretty good. And we did that for 2.5 years with Craig.
And as you know, improvisers can be lazy. How important is rehearsal, especially when you're starting out and you want to put up a show or more of a complicated long form? How important is it?
It's very important. I mean, you have to. I mean, we, you know, Jimmy, we probably see so many teams that don't rehearse and you see the results. I mean, you see the ones that work hard and you see the results. I mean, you have to work hard at it. And I feel oftentimes that's lost a little bit more these days. Because there is so much stage time available now. There wasn't as much stage time back then, so you really had to work to get on stage. And rehearsal, especially, like you said, as a younger age, you have to be doing it. Have a great coach, a great director, teaching you how to do this, becoming a group. You know, being an improv troupe is like being a family, you know? You can't just be, you know, at first you can be these sporadic people that come together, but then you got to really come together. I mean, that's how this art form works. You don't want to work against that. It just falls off the wheels.
And one of the secrets to coming together is just spending time with each other, either in rehearsal or out.
Yeah, exactly. And we would do that all the time. Like I said, we'd be there Sunday. We'd rehearse in the morning, go see movies, hang out in Hollywood all day, and then do our show. And we that's kind of where I came up with the idea for camp, because we used to go rent cabins up in Idlewild, which is here near LA, and we would stay on weekends together and just do that. And we even like did our own little rehearsals up there and experimented and said, oh, well, you can't do an improv show drunk. Like, you can't do this. Like, we would try stuff and see what our limits were and things like that. We discovered a lot up there.
And you said about Craig, you said that in those 2 years, most of what you've learned about this art form was there.
Yes. It's kind of backwards because, you know, usually at IO you learn the Herald first. Well, I did learn the Herald a little bit, but I learned the JTS Brown really before I really learned the Herald. And with the JTS Brown, there's so many moves and so many things and so much group mind taught that when I started doing the Herald, it opened the floodgates of like the possibilities of what you can do in an improv show, in an improv scene. You know, the JTS is very theatrical. So I really brought that to my work going forward. You know, like in a Herald, you can have non-edits. You can do certain things in other forms that have JTS background to it. Like, he really taught me all those things at an early age in improv, and I really appreciated it because it really did teach me. It goes, you know what, this isn't just theater. It's just not comedy. It's just not, we're make-em-ups. It's like, this is really artistic, and this can be something different. And I really enjoyed that about that.
And then you've been playing with a team called King Ten out there, and it's the longest-running Herald team in L.A. at IO West. Mm-hmm. Now, we just talked about rehearsals. I don't know if you guys still rehearse or not. My question is, how do you keep growing? Because when you're on a team for a long time, you can get into like bad habits, certain patterns, certain style of play. How do you keep learning?
That's a good question, Jimmy, because like it's tough. I mean, you know, people have kids, people are writing for television now. It's like people are doing stuff. So we don't rehearse every week. We try to rehearse every quarter. We get like a Bob Dassey or Craig or someone to come in to fine tune us, you know. And I will admit, Jimmy, we have our bad habits sometimes and we slip into them. And the thing about us, you know, I always tell to my students, don't coach each other. Don't tell us how the show is. But when you get to a vet stage where you've been together so long, we talk about the positive things that happened in the show. And we talk about, you know, what we need to improve on as a group. We don't talk to individuals and say, you did this wrong or you were this great or whatever. It's literally like, hey, we need to be more thematic. You know, we need to bounce out of our organic. We're doing the same organic opening. We need to do something different. So we talk and we're very open and honest about it. And I think that's important as communication with a team, especially a team that's been around that long. But yeah, we do get coached, but it's every once in a while. But admittingly, it's harder when you get older. I mean, it's just people's got careers and lives. But I think the work is still quality, though. I mean, obviously, we're still doing it. But yeah.
So tell me about you tell your students don't coach each other. Why is that?
It's just too toxic. I mean, you know, I've had, you know, if I'm not there or something and they decide to rehearse or something, or after a show, if I can't make it for some reason, someone will be like, well, I think this, or like you did this in this scene. You know, you can't do that. You're all peers. And I think it just is a slippery slope of someone getting offended. It's like, well, why are you telling me that? And that just is going to breed bad news for a team. You know, people are going to take offense to it, you know, that stuff. So I'm always just kind of like, you know what? Talk about the positive. I don't mind if you say this was great about the show and that. I'd rather you focus on that if I'm not there. But don't give each other notes. It's not your job. That's my job.
Is there a certain level where it's okay to give notes to each other?
You know, I really don't think so, Jimmy. I mean, like, I don't. I think it's too toxic, and I think people can take it the wrong way. And I don't think, you know, I mean, maybe if it was a vet team but I really only never coached like teams that have been around for years and years. But like, so I don't really have that experience to talk to. But for the younger teams, definitely no, it's not a good start. And it can also just make it a bad situation. It's not worth it. It's not worth it.
There also seems to be resistance with students after they paid for classes to hire a coach.
Resistance for, what do you mean by that, Jimmy?
In terms of, I've gone through the levels. I've gone through all the levels at whatever the institution is. And now they're asking me to hire a coach, to bring a coach in. And there can be resistance sometimes. What do you tell people? This question a lot. People will email me. How do you get them to a place to say, you know what? A coach is really valuable.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, I mean, I'd say look at these teams. Look at these teams that are great. Guess what they all have in common? The teams you love, they all rehearse every week. And they didn't get that way because they don't have a coach. I mean, all the best teams that I see, all the ones that rise to the challenge, and I see them progressively getting better, are all coached. So I say, well, here's your choice. You can get coached and get better and have stage time, or you can just hit stage time, be really bad, and then filter out, you know, because that's what's going to happen. And that is, you know, being an artistic director at West Side Comedy Theater, I see that all the time. I can tell you the teams. I won't put a team on stage that isn't coached because they're not going to be good.
I think another issue that I've been seeing here in Chicago is, and I don't know if it's true in LA, is Because I came up from groups like Jazz Freddy, where we rehearsed that show, I think, three times a week back then. We certainly saw the benefits. But today you're faced with, okay, we'd like you to commit to this rehearsal schedule, whatever it is. But you know what? I can actually go and do bar prov. I can get some stage time instead of doing a rehearsal.
Yep. That's a similar problem here, Jimmy. I think it's in the bigger communities like Chicago, New York, and L.A. There's more stage time, like I said earlier, and they're like, well, I don't want to spend money or time doing that. I just want to get on stage and do the thing. But I don't understand that mentality, and I don't understand where it's coming from. I guess I'm not in the trenches at that age anymore, but like, you know, it is tough. I mean, you know, there's so many indie spots and indie theaters, you know, at the main stages at like IO, things like that, we really filter that kind of stuff out. But then they have second stages and third stages where that's not really filtered out. So it's like, go play, get experience. And I'm about getting experience and have stage time. But like, I think a lot of stage time when you're young and not being coached only hurts you because you're learning bad habits.
And in 2011, you started doing something. You mentioned this earlier, called Improv Utopia, and it's a camp. You go for a week, right?
A weekend.
A weekend, and you're not only improvising, but you're out in nature as well. How do those two mix?
Well, I was a Boy Scout growing up. I was an Eagle Scout, so in California, which has some of the most beautiful nature there is, and summer camp was really a place where you had camaraderie, you had support. It was Boy Scouts was all about support your partner, support your troop. Again, the kind of same concepts. And then when I got into improv, I really loved that, and I was like, wow, this is kind of makes me feel like summer camp all the time. And so literally when I was in the Night Terrors, we would do these retreats together and it all felt the same. And I said, let's pull the trigger on this. Let's see if there's a camp, if there's such things as summer camps to rent. And boom, it happened. It happened pretty fast. We found one. We went, I mean, not fast from when I thought of it to get it. But once we looked at summer camps, it just went. And that combination really worked. And I wasn't expecting it to. I had no idea if it would. But it did, because the principles of both kind of things are the same.
And the first day, I believe, either you got up early or something, and you didn't think anybody was going to show up.
No.
Can you tell us that story?
So these people all paid. And like, I'm like scared, because I'm like, okay, people paid. This is happening. We got to do this. And so we get there at like 6 a.m, like with a table out. And like there, and nobody's coming, thinking people would come to the camp at 6 a.m. in the morning. I don't know where we thought about that. And so me and my buddy Johnny and Jessica were just sitting there waiting, and then waiting and waiting. And noon, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, we're like, nobody's coming. We're like, we're going to have to refund people. They don't know where it is. We didn't tell them where it is. We were panicking. And then I see a car pull up. Nope, staff member for the camp. We're like, damn it. Then I see another car come out, and out comes this guy, and he's looking around, and I recognize him a little bit because I think I met him at this Phoenix Improv Festival. It's Bob Fisher.
Yeah.
And I go, hey, we know you. Are you here for camp? And he goes, yes, is this it? We're like, yes. And literally after that, it was like Field of the Dreams, the line of cars back at the end, like coming in at that point. It was around like, I think, 4:35 that people started filtering in. It was great.
We got to take a quick break here, and then we'll be right back after this. You mentioned that you were afraid. I think fear is a huge thing. You know, getting to work with Del Close, he always talked about following your fear. But I think you got to be in touch with it before you can follow it. Tell me what you were afraid of.
I was afraid that it would fail, that like people wouldn't come, or that like, you know, we had this idea, we all put our money down for it, and it was a big risk. And, you know, we're always told in improv to take risks. And this was one of those risks. And I was following that philosophy. It was like, you know what, we can do this. Let's all put our money down, we may lose it, but let's do it. But it was the fear of like, maybe this fun idea won't work. And that was kind of a bummer, you know, feeling.
Was it easier to take the risk with other people? Just like an improv?
Yes. I mean, they had my back. I literally went to these guys and said, hey, I need money. Are we willing to put this down to back this up? And they did not hesitate. They said, yes, let's do it. This is going to be great. And it was nice to have that camaraderie with that those guys who are still with me today, helping me run the camp.
And this thing has just grown and grown and grown.
Yeah, yeah, it has. We started our East camp about 4 years ago now, and our Yosemite one last year, and we're starting an Ireland one next year.
What is different about doing it like off premise in the nature, away from everything for an extended weekend that is different than I'm taking a class once a week?
Well, when we set out to do this camp, it wasn't going to be all about improv. We do have improv workshops. You take improv workshops there. But it's also about getting in touch with nature. We do archery, axe throwing, things like that, canoeing. It's like a Boy Scout, Girl Scout camp meets there. So it is about getting in touch with that and like talking to people, being off your phones, being off technology. It's just really connecting with people from all over the world in a way you can't in a city when you have distractions and work and stuff. So it really takes out the distractions and you get a pure concentration of what improv is supposed to be.
Do you have to police people from hooking up or doing drugs and alcohol? Do you ever have to bust anyone?
You know, we don't really. Like, everybody's pretty good at it. You know, there's been people that have brought alcohol on premises or something like that. Or maybe there's drugs. I've never really seen it, but I've smelt it. You know, but that's legal now, I guess. But... you know, like there have been people that have hooked up. You know, I'm always the last to hear, Jimmy, because I'm the captain of the ship. So right. Like I hear like a week after camp has happened. Oh, did you know so-and-so? I was like, really? Like, you know, I mean, it does have that vibe to it too. There is, but nobody's ever gotten in trouble or anything like that. And we do have, you know, we do have policies, but nobody really breaks them.
Do you get, do you and the other people that do it, the students and or campers, I should say, and other teachers, do you get any sleep?
No. It is a very sleep-deprived weekend. I think that what plays into it, because people are up all night. We have activities that go to 11 o'clock. Then people go to the bar till 1, 2 in the morning. Then they wake up at 8 for breakfast, and it's boom, boom, boom. You know, it's a packed schedule. I hardly get sleep because I'm, you know, just making sure everybody's having a good time and that everybody's happy. You know, all the staff too. But everybody's just having a good time. And look, they're exhausted by Monday, but we want that. We want you to have this experience and you're shedding your defenses. You know, everybody's scared the first day, Jimmy. I will say that. Everybody is scared the first day of camp. And the moment, like 2 hours into it, you see this shield drop. And it's the most amazing thing of like, what is this? This is scary. I'm not used to this. This is not my comfort zone, to like this thing. And it's the most, it's, you can see the face drop, really. It's really physical and you can see, and it's such a nice thing to see. But then it's just, they just go, go, go.
How do you get them to drop that in that 2 hours? Is it improv or is it nature or is it a combination of both?
I think it's the people. They realize, oh, I'm with like-minded people. I'm with improvisers. They may be from San Francisco. I may be from San Diego, or I may be from Ireland or wherever, but they're the same people. Like, they're nice. They're supportive. They've got your back. They speak the same language. So it becomes this like scared thing of like, oh, these people I don't know, to like, I actually do know these people. These are my people. And I will say this, this one guy, Chris Berry, said it great. He goes like, I went there scared out of my mind. And I walked out of there with 100 or so best friends.
Your philosophy in improv is to have fun.
Yep.
As a teacher, I would imagine as a performer as well. How do you accomplish that in your classroom?
Well, you know, my friend John Crowley, before we do King 10, always goes, all right, we're doing a show for free, so let's have some fun. You know, like, so, and he's right, though. Like, look, we're doing this for free, but we're also, for the most part. But, you know, I really like, improv is supposed to be fun. Like, we're not doing in this to, like, shoveling coal or doing these hard, laborious jobs. Like, it is meant to lift the spirit. And you know, we want to see you having fun on stage. I want to see kids on a playground on stage and be jealous of that as an audience member and go, darn it, I wish I was playing with them.
So what's, it looks so fun. So what specifically in the classroom? Maybe it's an exercise. Maybe it's something you say. To give us a little glimpse inside your teaching that would encourage me, somebody who struggles to have fun in life on stage and in class, to have more fun.
Great. Well, I ask them if they're having fun. And sometimes I know they're not, but I still ask them.
Okay, I'm not having fun. I'm not having fun. I'm in your class right now. I'm not. Yeah. I'm Nick. I'm just not having fun. Yeah. I'm in my head.
Well, yeah, you're in your head. I can tell. Well, guess what? Scrap that scene. Get up there and just be silly. Just do it. Just do the stupidest stuff you can ever imagine and don't even think about it. And they just go wild. I said, scream. Scream like a child. You know, like, yeah, exactly. Like, you know, have fun. You know, and then they just, there's this relax, like, oh, it's just making it up. Like, it's just being silly. We're just being up there having a fun time. And I try to say, like, look, even the vets, you know, we've been doing it for so long. We're just trying to have a fun time. Remember your childhood innocence. It's like, remember, I try to them tap into the being a kid, you know, and like that reckless abandonment of like, just, I don't care what anybody thinks, because that's a lot of it, Jimmy. It's like, people are like, oh, people are going to think I'm stupid. It looks silly. And you got to get them out of that. You got to get them past that wall. So like, just trying to keep doing it. And then if you keep consistently making them be dumb and silly and stuff, they get over it. There's going to be a wall at first where they're going to do that, especially at like level one, where they're going to hit that. And you just got to be consistent. And I'm just consistently clapping for them. I'm laughing at them, even though I might sometimes not think it's the funniest thing. You know, like, I'm encouraging them, especially at level one. I want them to be there. And so, like, it's just consistency. Like, always trying to be, as a teacher, bringing off that attitude, showing how fun I love teaching and being fun as a teacher. And Paul Vallecourt rubbed that off on me. Like, he was my first level teacher. He loved it. He's passionate. And it made it easier for me to go like, oh, this is going to be fun. So I took that from Paul and really said, look, I've got to be a fun person too in that room. And look, like, I'm having a good time, because if I'm not, they're going to not believe me.
Give me the exercise that you do in class that would encourage me to be the silliest.
Let's see. What's one that I do? I love doing this one where they make up a name, any name at all. And it has to be interesting. Yes. It can't be like, you know, John Smith or Jane, whatever. It's got to be something interesting that doesn't matter.
Alan Guggenheim III.
And everybody goes, oh, we know Alan Guggenheim III. It's all in a circle. And everybody's like, and they start giving them traits. Silly or whatever it is, traits, you know, like, oh, he's got a limp. Oh, he has a British accent. Oh, she has a dog that she loves and is very defensive about. And then I go, you play that person. And they come out and they interact with everybody in the circle and they all have these characters. And it's just a freedom of like, they don't have to make it up. We're giving them the success so they don't have to have the pressure of thinking about all this stuff. So I've taken the pressure off of them. We as a team have given them everything they need, and all they have to do is be the superstar now. And it always works, and it's so fun.
So for me to understand this, and hopefully the listeners, because it sounds like a really fun exercise. Mm-hmm. So I would throw out the name like I just did, and then people would endow me with, he limps, he has a British accent, he's wearing a top hat, he's got a little dog that he carries around.
Exactly.
And then everybody else gets a turn too, where they make up a name? All right.
Yep. So then I go, next name, you know, give me another name. And then I pick who plays that.
Okay. You know? Then when we're all done with that, then what happens?
So then when they're done with giving you the traits, I point to the person. They just go out into the circle and pretend to walk and talk like this character. And they may interact with people in the circle, go like, oh, you look fancy too, my friend. Oh, you look fancy too. Like, and they may do a monologue. It's really up to them. I said, you just do what you want. I just want you to embody whatever this is. And you don't have to take every trait. You don't have to do everything. It's not a math equation where you're doing, you know, the top hat, the British accent, all this stuff. I said, whatever connects to you and that information, just take it and go. And it really relieves the pressure of them doing it. And they just have fun. And it's just stupid, silly.
And just to reiterate, we're all in a circle. We give everybody a trait, like Alan Guggenheim III. When they're all done, then I would step in the circle, right, and be that person.
Yes, I'd point to you and say, Jimmy, play that person. And then you would walk, do either a monologue as this character. You might not say anything. You might just walk as this character. You might talk to people in the circle, and then we'll clap you out. We'll be like, that was it. And then we cheer for you like a standing ovation.
Great. And then we ask Sarah to come up with the name, and we go so on and so forth.
Yeah.
That sounds like a great game. Now, you also, I love this. You feel that as a teacher, one of your jobs is to inspire them to be the best person they can be. Mm-hmm. Now, that seems to me like it's a daunting task. What do you mean by that?
Well, improv is one of those arts where it bleeds into your everyday life because everything's influencing you outside. And the Boy Scout in me obviously still lives in there. So we're always taught to be the best human you can be. And that positivity will give back more than you are given as a slogan, as an Eagle Scout you take. So I always say to them, I always give that slogan, be a better person. Be the best person on stage and off stage that you can be, because it only brings you opportunity. It brings you great people to play with, great people in your life, and that all influences everything. What happens off stage influences your life on stage in improv. So like, they work together. So you have to be the best human you can be.
And give me something concrete to do to be the best person, either on stage or off stage, as an improviser.
It's just being a good person, being positive, not being negative as much as you can. I mean, obviously it's hard. That I'm not saying I'm never negative. That's not true. You know, that is. But like, you have to click out of it and go, you know what? I'm just being negative. You got to be positive. You got to, that energy means so much to an audience, to your performers, and to people that surround you, and it attracts people. And I firmly believe that. And I feel that, you know, the camp has that vibe to it, you know, and things that of that nature. And whenever I put my stuff into that, that's what I put into it. This has to be positive. So that would be my example of something like that.
What do you do? Because you mentioned that, you know, no one can do it all the time. But let's say you've had a bad show and you want to beat up on yourself. Mm-hmm. I do this all the time. How do you snap out of that? How do you go from that negative place to more of a positive place? How do you catch yourself?
Well, and like I said, Jimmy, I have that all the time. And the thing is, I talk to myself in my own brain. Well, you had a shitty show, so. But guess what? Don't say it out loud. And guess what? Next week, you get to come back next week and you get to try again. And there's not a lot of opportunity to say that, I guess. Like, you get to try this again next week. Not every show is going to be a winner. And that's just the thing. We do this all the time. We have multiple shows a week. We do this once a week, whatever. We have another chance. And that's what I always tell myself. You have another chance.
So you've had a shitty show, because we all have them. And believe me, we're all still going to have them.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
Do you make any adjustments? Let's say you had a shitty show on Monday and you have a show on Thursday. Is there any adjustment during the week to put yourself in a better place the next time you perform?
Yeah, Jimmy, you know, I think about my performance, and, you know, with King 10, we don't have a coach watching us every week. So it is up to me to kind of talk to myself and go, okay, Nick, you really were talking over. I will give this. So in my show this week, I was talking over people. I talked over a performer, and it really irked me. I was like, gosh, that's so rude. That's so bad. I didn't give her an opportunity to say something, and I cut her off. And I did it a couple times. And it's just because I wasn't being patient. I wanted to move. And I should have felt the show and I should have laid into it, but I didn't. So my goal for next week, Jimmy, when I do King 10 on Wednesdays, I slow down, follow the group this time, let them lead and check yourself back in.
As a teacher and now the artistic director at MI Theater, Mission Improvable, people from Chicago, great, great people.
Yeah.
I've always found this very hard, is having students come and see you perform. And let's say you have a show where you talked over somebody like you did. How do you handle that the next time you're in class?
I point it out. I say, I'm honest. I am just transparent. I'm like, look, I'm a little honest. I'm showing you that a vet can even have a bad day, that it's going to happen, and that no matter how long you do this, know that you're never going to be perfect at it, and that's okay. And it's just how you get back. It's how you stand up and how you move forward. And that's how I try to say it. And I point out, I might go to the class next week and go, look, I talked over people and this was the result. I really messed things up in the vibe and rhythm of that scene or show. And they like the honesty. They like, because here's a vet, you or me, telling them that, like, I still mess up too. And it's okay. It's fine. I feel like, Jimmy, like, I don't know how when you teach, but, like, I always feel like when they graduate from something or they do something, they're like, I've got improv now. I've got the diploma. I'm good now. And I'm like, no, it still takes years. It's going to be years, maybe never. I don't know, you know, but, like, that diploma is such a thing that I wish we could get rid of in improv.
And you have an opportunity to get rid of it because you are now the artistic director. Mm-hmm. And what is that like for you from being a performer for all these years, camp director and founder of Improv Utopia? Now you're an artistic director.
Yeah, it's a lot different, Jimmy. I love it because the West Side Comedy Theater where I teach is, they have a great community and they make it very easy. But it's different, Jimmy, because I'm also in charge of cutting people and hurting people's feelings. And I don't have to do that at camp. And I don't have to do that as a performer. But I'm in charge of people's lives a little bit now. And that's really hard for me, you know. But I've learned to do it. But I tell you, I watch all their I do so much work to make sure that I'm doing the best job that I can to make those decisions. And I always have an open door policy where people can talk about why I've done what I've done and how they can get better. And that's been the hard part because then, Jimmy, I've got to go on stage the day I cut people and perform. Like, you know, and like, what if I have a bad show and that person that's cut out in the audience goes, oh, he should cut himself. You know, like, I mean, it's a lot of pressure. And Jimmy, I've only done this for like a year almost as an artistic director, and I'm still learning how to do it. Like, there's no rules to how to be an artistic director in improv. It's you know, and there's no book, you know, and there's and so we're just kind of, I talk to people like, you know, Mike Dakota from Improv Boston, I ask advice and they've always been great. But like, I'm still trying to figure out how to be an artistic director and how to be a performer at the same place. It's tough.
The other thing I think is interesting that you mentioned, you reach out to other people. And I try to do that a lot. How important is that?
So important. I mean, someone like Mike, I think, has been doing Improv Boston for 6 years, and he's a great artistic director. I mean, and Brian O'Connell, who runs the PAC Theater, also runs camp with me. Like, people around Zach Huddleston and Colleen at IO. The great thing is we communicate. Like, there's no walls at our theaters anymore. In LA, there's been a big shift of who controls the theaters out here. And now it's people from my generation who have all been at the same theaters and cross-pollinated. And it's been, hey, this isn't working at our theater. What works at your theater? You know, and it's like this. We did a show where an IO main stage team played at our stage and a West Side team went to a main spot at IO, and it was hugely successful for both theaters.
Go on.
I was going to say that, but that's it, Jimmy. Like, it's to communicate is only going to help all of us.
Tell me how important those walls coming down, because I think every community, I know in Chicago, this is going back in the 90s, it was like, and I've talked about this on the podcast, it was like street gangs. Everybody was very territorial. There was Comedy Sports, there was The Annoyance, there was IO, there was Second City, and everybody was separate. And then when I've traveled, and I know you've traveled and done festivals, you'll go into a small market and there'll be, you know, this theater has a resentment towards this theater. And tell us the benefit when those walls came down in LA for the benefit for the whole community.
Well, you and I maybe eat, sleep, drink improv, but the rest of the world doesn't. And they don't know what it is still. And if you take a city of LA that has 4 or 5 million people and you at any night have maybe 200 seats that service improv in your whole city, there is no reason why you guys all can't work together to raise the idea of improv. Groundlings does this style. IO does this. UCB does this. They're all different flavors of ice cream. And you're going to go to either one to get those flavors. And that's the thing. Like, that's why you drop your walls and work together. It's for the betterment of everybody. That's why I love that there's more improv camps now and things like that. Like, bring it on. Like, it only helps all of us. You know, when I did the improv network, it was the same thing. It was like, let's drop the walls. That's what camp is about now. It's like, we get these theaters that are feuding to talk to each other. Sometimes we do these improv summits there. It's like, and I always end the camp by saying, take what you've learned here and go back to your cities and your towns and your communities and work together.
So when you're in a summit, because you've seen a lot of summits, you've brought a lot of communities together, I think this is very fascinating. What is the underlying thing, that theme that you found that keeps people apart?
Well, it usually starts, like anything, with a theater that had some people that don't have a disagreement. So that person decides to split off and start their own theater. So there's already animosity between maybe owners. So it doesn't come from improv necessarily. It comes from people and egos. And then that splits off. And then they start their own theater, whatever, at whatever city. And then there's a lot of not communicating. I'm going to do better than you. I'm going to crush you. I don't believe in what you're doing. And there still is that, Jimmy. And sometimes you're never going to get rid of that. It's just going to be that way. But I have found that the communities that I go to that work together are the best communities they are. They have the best festivals. They have the best theaters. They work together. And I feel L.A. is starting to get that, because L.A. had that too, maybe in the mid-2000s, where UCB had kind of come and there was a breaking off point where, like, just like boom, it exploded into five different shards. But now I feel it's coming together. There's new ownership to the theaters, artistic directors, and we're saying, no, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. We're all working together. It hasn't affected our theaters in any way by working together. It's just helped them.
Now, you talked about the hard part of being an artistic director. What is the rewarding part?
The rewarding part is seeing the results. It's seeing a team do better. It's seeing the care that you take for the space work. It's seeing more people coming to see the shows because what you've done and the decisions you've made have made quality performers. It's seeing the successes of those performers. It's seeing them come in, take it seriously, talk to me about it, and then go up on stage and go, you are such a better performer than just a year ago. Like, I had this one performer that was really struggling, got cut from a team, and now is on the best team there, Jimmy, in a year. And that, to me, makes it worth it, because he took the time to work, to talk to me, to talk to his coaches, to become a better person and do well. And that, to me, made it all worth it, if it's just even that one person.
Do you have, because every market is different, do you have the added pressure, because you're in LA, the industry town, and you certainly have been on television shows and audition and in commercials and stuff like that. Is there this pressure like, I want something from this. I'm going to be good at improv, but really, I'm hoping to get on a sitcom or be in a movie.
No, because I can still do that. I mean, like, that career is here. And then the artistic director thing I took because it was a challenge for me. I said, this is something I've never done before, and it's going to challenge me. And I don't take on a job thinking I'm going to make money. I take a job because, like, if I would have said no watching that first Herald show, I'll take classes later, I might have never done it. I signed up for the next day. So when they offered me this artistic director job, I was like, you know what? This is going to be a challenge. I got to do it, because I'm going to learn something about myself as an artist too. So I guess in a way, yes, I'm learning something about myself. That's kind of selfish in a way. But like, I want to grow still as that. And I also want to help other artistic directors, because I travel so much and I want to have that experience and go, well, I've experienced this. Now we can talk about it.
What are you learning about yourself in this job?
That I'm learning that it's a business too. And that, as an artistic director, you have to balance business with keeping the door open and the talent. And some of those talent are your friends, and that you got to cut them, but you have to keep the rent. You are the mediator between the talent and the business part. You are the middle man. And you really have to learn how to play that line. And you really have to learn both sides of it. You have to learn about more about the talent side of it and how to keep people inspired and going and signing up. And you have to keep the doors open because you're responsible for booking the shows, making sure the ticket revenue is coming in and all that. There's a lot of admin to it too, you know? And that's something you're thinking, oh, I just have to watch shows. You're like, no, it's not just that. You have to do a lot. So that's what I learned. You're the middleman.
We've got to wrap this up. This has been great. We always ask the same question to end the podcast, which is, what piece of advice would you give somebody starting out in improv today?
Remember, you're not going to ever be perfect at it, and that's okay. And that you should keep learning. I don't care how long of a vet you are. Keep learning. That doesn't mean necessarily taking classes. That means reading a book. That means doing something different. Experience life. That would be my main thing. And always have fun.
Nick Armstrong, thank you so much. The artistic director at the West Side Comedy Theater, is that correct?
Correct, yeah.
Also the camp director and founder of Improv Utopia, and also a co-founder of the National Improv Network.
The Improv Network now.
So it's now just the Improv Network?
Yeah, it's worldwide now. Yeah.
Oh, my God, congratulations. Thank you so much for being our guest.
Thanks, Jimmy. This has been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
And there you have it, another episode of Improv Nerds in the Canon. I want to thank our guest, Nick Armstrong, and I love what he talked about being an artistic director and explaining how hard that job can be. So it just gives us a little more compassion, because those are hard decisions to make, deciding if people should be on teams or not. I also want to thank my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you wouldn't be hearing my voice right now. Also, if you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning classes, workshops, and intensives called The Artist Low Comedy, or just to sign up for my Improv Nerd blog, go to jimmycorain.com. Also, don't forget our Patreon. Patreon.com/ImprovNerd. We're doing a Patreon subscription, so if you could support it, it would be great. Every month, we are going to release a full video of an episode of Improv Nerd, which is great. But here's the best part, and we filmed this a couple weeks ago, and we released the first one last month. I am putting together a series of like master class videos. So if you're in a smaller market and you don't have access to teachers, you will see some of the games. Not only how to do them, but how to teach them. So each month we'll release a different series of games and lessons on this Patreon. So go to Patreon.com/ImprovNerd to check that out. And really, we need your support on that. Also, go to our YouTube channel to see clips from the Improv Nerd Show. Twitter, Improv_Nerd. Follow us there. And also our Facebook page. Like us on Facebook, because it helps with my low self-esteem. We are so blessed to be part of this podcast collective called Feral Audio. Check out all their wonderful podcasts at feralaudio.com. And also, if you are going to buy something on Amazon, go to feralaudio.com, hit the donate button, and a couple pennies come our way to keep this little podcast going. And of course, thank you for listening. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Say Seinfeld was on an island and he was blowing Boris Karloff. What would that be like?
And it might go something like this. Oh, Mr. Karloff, I loved you in Frankenstein, and I love giving you a blowjob. Why, Mr. Seinfeld, I love having you